Hey folks, O'Sheen here. Hope you're doing well in whatever corner of the world that you're in. As I'm recording this, Ireland has just gone into its third lockdown, so fingers crossed this will be the last, but who knows. Before I get into this episode, I'm going to play a short promo for the podcast Murderish, which is a true crime podcast that delves into the true stories of murder, disappearances, and other creepy events.
Hi, I'm Jamie, host of Murderish, a true crime podcast that provides a 3D look at gripping murder cases from beginning to end. You'll get to know the victims and perpetrators, how their worlds collided, and what went down during trial. I also share some of my own personal experiences, like the time a stranger came into my bedroom at night. Yeah, that really happened, and I walk you through all the details of that terrifying night. Have you ever wanted to be a fly on the wall during a murder trial? You'll get that opportunity on Murderish, as I share my experience being a jury foreman on a first-degree murder trial. Search Murderish in your favorite podcatcher app, hit subscribe, and start binging. And remember, listening to this podcast doesn't make you a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish.
Also, I just want again to thank all my Patreons for their ongoing support. And if you'd like to donate the price of a pint or a cup of coffee, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Or if you prefer to do a once-off donation, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. Now, let's get back to the show. June 18th, 1994, in the small village of Lochan Island in the Northern Irish county of Down, there was a crowd of people in the tiny Heights bar watching the Republic of Ireland play Italy in the 1994 World Cup. This was only the second time the Irish team had gotten into the World Cup, so it was a fairly big deal for Irish people. At 10 minutes past 10 at night, two men dressed in boiler suits and balaclavas walked into the bar, and as they walked in, they shouted, "Fenian bastards," and then opened fire on the unarmed crowd. They then disappeared into the night. The incident went on to become known as the Lochan Island Massacre, and what was revealed over the next 20 years has led this massacre to become one of the most stark and startling examples of collusion between the police and the loyalist paramilitary group, the UVF. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Just a heads up before we get into this episode, the timeline for the massacre is quite complex, and many details of the story weren't revealed until over 20 years later. I'll be explaining what happened as the information became available to the victims' families, so there'll be some jumping back and forth. Also, the main source for this episode is the Emmy-nominated documentary made about the massacre, called No Stone Unturned. It was released in 2018 and is an exceptional piece of investigative journalism. It's directed by Alex Gibney. Now, back to the episode. Jack Charlton was an English football player who played for England when they won the 1966 World Cup. In later years, he managed a number of English teams before being offered the position as manager of the Republic of Ireland national team in 1986. Under Charlton, the team went on to have its most successful period in history, which became known as the Golden Years. The Irish team made it into their first World Cup in 1990, where they reached the quarter-finals. They then made it into the subsequent World Cup in 1994, which was hosted in the USA. The fact that the Irish team even made it into the World Cup was a massive event for people on the island of Ireland. Their first match of the 1994 World Cup was against Italy, who had knocked Ireland out in the previous World Cup of 1990, so there was no doubt it would be a tense affair. In Northern Ireland, sport and music were a welcome and necessary relief from the daily bombings and shootings that were always in the news. And for the Republic of Ireland to go toe-to-toe against Italy, it was a big deal. The Troubles were raging on by this stage, and in the 90s, the Loyalist Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, had dramatically increased their attacks on Catholics and Irish nationalists. So much so that for the first time, they were now responsible for more deaths than Republicans or security forces. On June 18th, 1994, millions of people on the island of Ireland were watching the Irish team play Italy. In the small village of Lochan Island, 16 people were crammed into the Heights Bar, which also went by the name O'Toole's Pub. Lochan Island was quite an unassuming village, with no known IRA or UVF activity. The pub itself was quite small, and probably the size of an average sitting room of a house, so 16 people meant it was fairly crammed, with all eyes on the small television in the corner of the pub. The whistle was blown and the match began. The Irish team had got off to an aggressive start, and then struck gold at the 11th minute.
Sheridan. Baresi, onto it comes Houghton. And Houghton with a shot, and it's there!
Ray Houghton caught the Italian goalkeeper off guard with a beautiful chip that sent the ball into the back of the net. This would be the only goal scored of the match, and Ireland would go on to beat Italy. Unfortunately, for those in the pub, that wouldn't matter. 5 minutes after the goal, at 10:10, the door to the pub opened and two masked gunmen walked in. They were wearing boiler suits and balaclavas, and one was armed with an assault rifle. One of them shouted, "Fenian bastards," and then the man with the rifle opened fire, spraying the small room in a hail of gunfire. Upwards of 60 shots were fired into the small pub. The gunmen then retreated to a getaway car, with a witness hearing them laughing as they fled the scene. Inside the pub was utter carnage. Photos from the scene show the floor completely covered in blood. 11 people were shot and 6 people died. The victims were Adrian Rogan, 34, Malcolm Jenkinson, 52, Barney Green, 87, Daniel McCreener, 59, Patrick O'Hare, 35, and his brother-in-law, Eamon Byrne, 39. 87-year-old Barney Green has the unfortunate title of being the oldest person to be killed during the Troubles. Aidan O'Toole, whose father Hugh owned the pub, was working as a barman that night and recalls the moment the shooting started.
After the goal was scored, just about 5 minutes after, the door opened and all you hear was cracks. The gunfire. I ran up the bar and ran into the store.
Did you see anything?
No. Just hear the cracks of the gun and run up the bar and just to get away from him, knew something was happening.
At 11:40 that evening, a local newsroom received a call from someone who used a recognised code word and said the attack was carried out by the UVF. They claimed that a Republican meeting was taking place there, and that's why the pub was targeted. This claim was proven to be untrue, and there is no evidence that the pub had any link to Republican activity. The killings caused shock and horror around the world. There had been hope that a peace process was just around the corner, and this senseless killing of innocent people watching a football match really struck a chord with the public. The Queen and the Pope sent letters of condolences to the victims' families, and many members of the Protestant community who lived nearby also expressed their shock and outrage at the killings. Hugh O'Toole was the owner of the pub and was away in Romania on a charity trip. When he returned home, he was in a state of shock as he arrived and visited the scene.
It's just destroyed me.
You obviously weren't able to stay in the pub very long.
Jesus, the blood stuff. I didn't think possible here. Like a quiet, comfy pub. It doesn't make that ever happen. It should happen to you.
What would you say of your friends, your cousins?
Great people. Best of people. I don't know. I can never stand behind a bar again. Look at that.
On the day of the funeral, Patrick Mayhew, who was the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, issued a powerful statement aimed at the gunmen.
To those who have done this, those who have killed these people, my message to them is this. I suppose some of you have families. Let's just picture a future conversation that you may have with your daughter, who asks you what you did in your so-called war, Daddy. And you will say, I killed a man of 87. He was sitting with his back to me. He was watching the World Cup. I shot him dead. She won't think that the record of a hero, will she? Now, I want to say this at the end. You are going to be caught sooner or later, the RUC. Never give up. and you will be caught and you will spend long years in prison.
As well as Mayhew's statement, a number of RUC officers came to Adrian's wake and said to his wife Claire that they would leave no stone unturned in their quest to find the perpetrators who carried out the attacks. Unfortunately, as the years dragged on, these assurances would prove to be quite hollow. The investigation into this attack looked quite promising. One day after the attack, the getaway car was discovered abandoned in a field 7 miles from Lochan Island. It appeared to have been pushed off the road and into the field. Usually a getaway car would be burned out so as to destroy the evidence, but in this case it wasn't. Investigating officers thought that this was a stroke of good luck, and this could provide them with plenty of forensic evidence to help catch the attackers. Then, 6 weeks later, in another field, more evidence was located, including the VZ-58 rifle used in the attacks, as well as overalls, gloves, balaclavas, and handguns. A follicle of hair was even found in one of the balaclavas. This was a huge amount of evidence when compared to other attacks, so there was a lot of hope that people would be arrested. The rifle had also been linked to 3 other attacks which could help narrow the net of the people to be investigated. 1 month after the attack, 6 people were arrested. Forensic samples were taken off them, but it's reported that there were inconsistencies in the taking of these samples. The 6 were then released without charge. Over the next couple of years, there were many people arrested as part of this investigation, and one report even stated that there were as many as 136 suspects. Despite all the individuals arrested and rearrested, no one was ever charged and time started to drag on. Then, 1 year later, out of the blue, a local councillor received an anonymous letter which they then passed on to the RUC. The letter named a number of individuals who were allegedly involved in the murders. As well as that, an anonymous call had been placed to a police station claiming to know the identity of the men involved in the killings. We'll come back to the letter later as it's quite important. Over the next 4 years, more arrests of the same individuals occurred, but each and every time, the people were released without charge. Then, on the 10th anniversary of the killings, families of the victims decided to band together, frustrated at the lack of progress on the case and the lack of information emanating from the RUC. Then, in 2006, they got together and held a press conference demanding justice and transparency. Here's Niall Murphy, who was the solicitor for the victims' families, talking about the police investigation.
By the end of 2005, we had 3 meetings with senior police officers. The police were saying, we have the boiler suits, we have the balaclavas, we have the weapons, we had the car. And I thought, had the car? Where is the car?
It transpired that the car used in the attack was destroyed by the RUC 10 months into the investigation, after they felt that it had been thoroughly examined. As well as that, all of the original notes made during interviews with suspects had been destroyed. The reason provided was that the notes had been contaminated with asbestos, and it was a safety issue. It's at this stage I need to talk about the idea of collusion. This is a topic which comes up in nearly every episode related to the Troubles. Collusion can come in many forms. The most literal example would involve a policeman helping a paramilitary to carry out an attack, either directly or by turning a blind eye. But there are many forms. There could be police informants hidden inside paramilitary organisations who know the details of an upcoming attack but choose not to share them so as not to blow their cover. During the Troubles, the British state has been accused of collusion a number of times. And at the very highest level, currently there are millions of documents being withheld by the British government, which are deemed still too sensitive to release. There are many, many ways in which collusion can take place. And it has been a focal point for many victims' families who are searching for justice for their loved ones who died during the Troubles. After the Lochan Island massacre, there were many suspects and a lot of evidence, including the hair sample recovered from a balaclava near the scene. Despite all this evidence, there was never any individual charged. But then when the victims' families found out about the destruction of evidence, this was a tipping point. They wanted to know, was this simply a botched investigation, or was it deliberately buried? They hoped to find answers to these questions in the Hutchinson Report. In 2011, Al Hutchinson, who was the police ombudsman for Northern Ireland, released the first report on Lochan Island. The report is lengthy, but I'll try to explain some of the most significant findings. It found that the initial police response was immediate and effective. It also found that the investigation at the place where the car was found was appropriate, but then there were failings analysing statements associated with the car ownership, which could have provided some significant lines of inquiry. The report went on to explain that the car should not have been destroyed without the express permission of the senior investigating officer of the killings at Lochan Island, something which did not occur. Overall, the report was satisfied with the effort made to arrest suspects, but said that there were failings in the overall forensic strategy. It found that the police failed to communicate effectively with the victims and survivors of the attack. The report concluded saying that there was no intelligence or information that the police could have obtained which could have prevented the attack, and no evidence that the police colluded with loyalists. Basically, it said that the investigation was sloppy, but there was no collusion. Upon its release, the report was heavily criticised. SDLP Councillor Margaret Ritchie said of the report, quote, "It completely lets down the victims' families and the wider community. The Ombudsman paints a picture of an incompetent Keystone Cops type of police force where the reality was that the RUC and Special Branch were rotten to the core." Niall Murphy, the solicitor, said of the report, quote, "The Ombudsman has performed factual gymnastics to ensure there was no evidence of collusion in his conclusion." The report was widely slated, and Hutchinson went on to resign shortly after the release of the report. He had reportedly lost the trust of his senior colleagues. The families of the victims launched a lawsuit aiming to overturn the conclusions made in this report, which was successful and led to a subsequent investigation in 2013 by Michael Maguire, which was published in 2016 and is known as the Maguire Report. The Maguire Report had significantly more depth than the Hutchinson one and looked into the background of the killings and also where the weapons came from. When it came to the topic of collusion, the Maguire Report was much more direct, stating, quote, "I have no hesitation in unambiguously determining that collusion is a significant feature of the Lochan Island murders." It also looked into what led to the Lochan Island massacre, and it's at this point we're going to take a step back. I frequently mentioned that the Troubles consisted of a huge amount of tit-for-tat style killings, and the build-up to what happened in Lochan Island is no exception. On the 16th of June 1994, and 2 days before the attack, the INLA, who are a Republican paramilitary organisation, shot dead three UVF members, Trevor King, Colin Craig and David Hamilton, in a drive-by shooting on the Shankill Road in Belfast. The Maguire report then says that senior members of the UVF then called for there to be blood on the streets and to kill any Catholic to get justice for the three slain UVF members. The first revenge killings happened the day after the killing of the three UVF men. A civilian Catholic taxi driver was shot dead, then two Protestant civilians were also killed, who the gunman had believed were Catholics. Then, one night later, the Lochan Island massacre took place. The investigation also revealed that the weapon used on the night was a VZ-58 rifle, which looks very similar to an AK-47. This weapon was quite distinct, and police were easily able to identify how it entered the country. A sizeable cache of weapons were bought in South Africa and shipped into Northern Ireland around early 1988. They were then divided between a number of different loyalist paramilitary groups. The Maguire report revealed there was police informants involved in this operation. In the report, Maguire says, quote, "Reliable intelligence indicates that police informants were involved in the procurement, importation and distribution of these arms. The failure to stop or retrieve all the weapons, despite the involvement of informants in the arms importation, was a significant intelligence failure." When it came to the Lochan Island investigation itself, the report went on to make some very startling discoveries. But before we get into that, I'll need to discuss who the RUC Special Branch are. They were the intelligence gathering part of the RUC. They handled informants and covertly watched those they suspected of being involved in paramilitary groups. The Maguire report stated that for the past 6 years, Special Branch officers had been watching men from a loyalist gang who'd carried out a number of attacks which were incredibly similar to what happened in Lochan Island. But more importantly, Special Branch identified 5 suspects 1 day after Lochan Island. But despite this, the suspects weren't arrested and questioned until 1 month later. This delay heavily affected the ability for evidence to be gathered. The report also revealed that one of the suspects was an informer who was being managed by RUC Special Branch. Then, when the RUC were investigating the massacre, Special Branch did not pass relevant information to them in order to protect their informer. The report went on to say that UVF members had close relatives who worked at local police stations and within the police force itself. A police officer allegedly warned chief suspects on the 21st of August 1994 that they would be arrested the following morning. Maguire said that this was inexcusable that police had not investigated this. The report also looked into the details of the getaway car, which had been sold one day before the attack was carried out. It soon emerged that the person who sold the car was an undercover officer. It also found that the security forces were compromised by having associations with loyalist paramilitaries. The report was certainly an eye-opener with the extent to which informers were involved in the case, and the extent to which it appeared that they were being protected. It was welcomed by the families, but some members of the police force disagreed with the conclusions that it had drawn and went to court, seeking to quash the report. This bid was rejected and the report was upheld. Despite the eye-opening nature of the report, there was still one problem. In order to protect witnesses and to protect the names of people who had been arrested but not charged, the Maguire report redacted the names of the policemen and suspects, instead numbering the policemen and attaching letters to the suspects so their identities would be hidden. The documentary No Stone Unturned explains it well, saying that they now had the plot, but none of the characters. The key person of interest was referred to as Person A in the report. He was a member of the British Army who lived beside a loyalist club. He was arrested and released without charge, but the arresting officer was concerned that the individual still posed a threat. With this fog clouding over the report, the families had reached a stopping point in their search for the truth. But this fog was lifted by something that happened in 2011, when journalist Barry McCaffrey received a leaked document in the Post that would reveal a lot about the investigation. McCaffrey was involved in the production of the documentary No Stone Unturned, and had anonymously received an early draft of the first report, the Hutchinson Report, which was a version that didn't have any names redacted. So using the details from this report, such as arrest records, the documentary makers were able to cross-reference it against the Maguire report and essentially fill in the blanks and find out the names of all the suspects involved. This version revealed some critical details about the case that had never been released before. It's at this point we return to the anonymous letter that was sent. The redacted report pointed out who had received it. It was SDLP councillor called Patsy Toman. He then passed the letter on to the RUC, who lost it, but luckily Patsy had kept a copy. Patsy was interviewed for the documentary, where he revealed the contents of the letter, but was visibly uncomfortable and flat out refused to read out the names on the letter of the alleged men involved in the attack. Even 20 years later, he was still worried about loyalist reprisal attacks. He had also previously had his house bombed by loyalists, so it is understandable. The letter went on to name all three men who were allegedly involved in the attacks in Lochan Island. It turns out that the police had investigated this letter and identified the author, who was the wife of one of the alleged attackers. In the letter, she claimed that she was involved in the planning of the attack, but then was unable to take part in it on the night. She then expressed remorse in the letter for the murders. However, local police said that she was doing this to punish her husband for infidelity. She was arrested and interviewed, but was then released without charge, and the notes from her interview while arrested have since been destroyed. So why wasn't she charged? Okay, the last few minutes have been quite dense, so let's just take a moment to go over the facts of this case. Six people are killed by two men in a bar, one of which was armed with an assault rifle. A car, gun, balaclava and hair sample are recovered nearby the scene. Special Branch had identified a number of suspects in the attack, but these suspects weren't arrested until a month later. Then a letter arrived naming three people involved, and these men were already considered suspects. Hair was taken from the suspects and was a partial match with the follicle of hair recovered from the balaclava. The car used in the attack was destroyed without notifying the officer in charge of the investigation. The anonymous letter was lost by the RUC, and notes from the original investigation had to be destroyed because of asbestos contamination. And no one was ever charged for these killings. Families of the victims have no doubt that this investigation was covered up in order to protect an informant. But what was the price? Did protecting this informant prevent another mass bombing? Or did it prevent the RUC or British Army from looking bad? The answer to these questions we may never know. The release of the Maguire Report in 2016 was a turning point in the quest for the truth, but time will tell if the full story will ever be released. Since 2016, there have also been some developments. Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burnley both worked on the documentary No Stone Unturned, and it was Barry who received the leaked unredacted report in 2011. On the 31st of August 2018, the two were detained by the PSNI in relation to the theft of sensitive materials. Their homes and offices were also searched. The police alleged that the men had stolen the documents or handled stolen goods. The men were accused of breaching the Official Secrets Act and potentially risking the lives of the suspects by publicly naming them. In 2020, the Belfast High Court found the search warrants to be inappropriate. Also, 2012 was the 18th anniversary of the attack, and the Republic of Ireland football team were taking part in the Euro 2012 Championship. As a sign of respect for the victims at Lochan Island, the team all wore black armbands during the match. Hugh O'Toole, the owner of O'Toole's Bar, wanted to close its doors after the massacre, but it was convinced not to by the community, and the bar is still open today, with a memorial to the victims in the corner of the pub. That's it for this episode for now. As of writing, 2021, there have been no major developments, but I'll make sure to update this episode if there are. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.